"How's the arm?" asked Decker.
"Hurts a lot less than when you hit me on that screen pass back in college."
"You're just trying to cheer me up. That was the only time I tackled you all game."
"Still, a good hit."
"Yeah, you hit me so hard about 15 times that I stayed in bed for 3 days because I couldn't feel any part of my body." Decker refocused on his beer, but his attention was obviously far away.
"Things not going so good?" asked Mars.
"I wish I could tell you, but you're not cleared for it. Hell, I'm probably not cleared for it either."
"Nothing you can tell me?"
"You could say we only half finished the job, and the most important half is still out there."
Alex was a little more forthcoming. She said there was big shit maybe going down soon, only you guys didn't know what.
"That sums it up pretty well, actually."
Mars took another sip of beer. "Anything I can do?"
"You got a miracle in your pocket?"
"Not last time I looked."
"Then no, I don't think there's anything you can do."
"That bad, huh?"
"That bad. You seen Harper since the shootout at her house?"
"No."
"How come?"
"I think she wants to cool things, at least for now."
Decker looked surprised. "Why? I thought she liked you."
Mars sighed. "She does. Maybe too much."
"I'm not following."
"I think she's afraid I'll get hurt if I keep hanging around her."
"Well, the same could be said for me."
"Hell, I need to hang out with somebody, Decker."
"I won't stop you."
Mars looked at him quizzically. "How come?"
"Because I don't like you as much as Brown does, for obvious reasons."
Mars grinned and lightly punched him on the arm.
"Asshole."
Decker's phone buzzed. It was Jameson. Well, it was her number, but it wasn't Jameson.
"Mr. Decker?"
"Who is this?" said Decker sharply.
The voice said,
"Irrelevant to the matter at hand. What is relevant is that Miss Jameson is a guest of ours."
Decker stood.
"Where's Alex? What do you want?"
"Excellent question. The answer to that would be you."
"I want to talk to Alex, now."
Mars had put his beer down and was standing next to Decker, looking concerned.
A moment later, Jameson came on the phone. Her voice was shaky.
"It's me, Amos."
"Where are you?"
"I don't know. I was getting out of my car when..."
There was a scuffle and the man's voice came on again.
"She's alive for now. You're a very intelligent man, so you know what I'm going to ask you next."
"Where?"
"Not quite that easy, since we don't want your mates at the FBI to join the party."
"How, then?"
"We understand that you have a good memory."
"What of it?"
"I'm going to talk fast. Don't forget a thing. Your friend won't appreciate it."
The man spoke for about a minute. Decker clicked off and looked at Mars.
"I gotta go."
"So do I."
"See you later."
"No, I mean I'm going with you."
"That's not gonna happen, Melvin."
"Then your ass ain't leaving this bar, Decker."
"Melvin, I
heard what you said on the phone. Alex is in trouble, so it's either we both go or neither one of us is going."
"Do you remember the last time we went somewhere to meet somebody?"
"Considering we almost got blown to shit, yeah, I remember."
"Well, these people have no incentive to let any of us live."
"Never doubted it."
"And you're still in?"
"Like you gotta ask. Lead the way, dude."
Chapter 76. The instructions Decker had been given were complicated, which didn't surprise him. First, a bus that carried him west. Next, a rental car in his name waiting for him at an airport. Then he drove according to the directions he'd been given. He passed rolling hills and flat expanses. The trees bent under blustery winds, which grew stronger the farther he went. It was colder, and the sky had swiftly changed from clear to foreboding. He looked behind to see if there were any headlights back there. He was armed, but knew that would be useless once he reached his destination. They held all the cards, since they had Jameson. He slowed as he came to the junction he'd been looking for. He pulled off the road. A van was waiting there. It blinked its lights. He got out, and the side door of the van slid open. A man crouched there, aiming a gun at him. He had on no mask, so Decker could clearly see his features.
Well, that wasn't good.
They obviously weren't worried that he was going to live to tell anyone anything. The man flicked his gun at Decker, and he walked over to the van. His legs were stiff from the long drive, and he tripped over his feet, hitting the dirt right next to the van. The man didn't move to help him. Decker gripped the side of the van as leverage to hoist his bulk back up, while the man kept his gun trained on him all the way.
"Not very light on your feet, are you?" said the man snidely.
"I guess not," said Decker, a bit out of breath. Two other men climbed out of the back of the van. They searched him thoroughly, even using an electronic wand, but found only his gun and no tracking devices. His hands were bound with zip ties, and he was pushed roughly into the van. The door was closed, and the van pulled onto the road and sped off. The men said nothing, and Decker was not inclined to conversation. The van had no windows, so he couldn't see where they were going. Not that it mattered.
"I just want to see Alex, alive."
They drove for about a half hour, and finally the van pulled to a stop. The door opened, and Decker was hustled out. He looked around and saw that they were in front of a dilapidated house, with a waist-high, falling-down wooden fence surrounding it. When he looked around, he saw no other structure. The place looked to be in the middle of nowhere. All he could see in any direction was darkness. There were lights on in the house, but they were low. Decker doubted the electricity was on in this place. It looked abandoned. His captors marched him up to the sagging front porch. The door opened, and he was led in. When the door closed behind him and his eyes adjusted to the light, Decker could see that he had been right. Battery-operated lanterns were situated in several different places, giving the place a low glow, like pockets of lightning bugs were flitting around. The room smelled of mildew and decay. As soon as he saw her, he couldn't take his gaze off her. Alex was seated on a couch whose stuffing guts were spilling out through holes in the cushions. She had on a gag, but her eyes were staring back at Decker. He finally drew his gaze from her and looked around. Five other men and one woman were standing around in the small room. Even without the wig, Decker recognized the woman as the one in the bank video with Walter Dabney. He was surprised to see that two of the men looked Middle Eastern. The woman moved forward and appraised Decker.
"You are stubborn,"
she said, her accent pronounced. Decker held her gaze. "You're much younger than Anna. Are you her protege? Since she's dead, I guess you can move up now." Her features turned ugly.
"She should never have died."
"We all have to die one day," said Decker. The woman glanced at Jameson and then back at him.
"And so this is your day."
"Killing us won't stop the investigation. The FBI is a pretty big organization. This will just make them try harder." The woman smiled at this.
"No one knows what the future will bring."
She paused.
"But I think I can predict your and your friend's future."
"I can see why you might think that."
"I am surprised you came so willingly to your death."
"Alex is my friend. She has my back. I have hers."
"Then this is good. So you can die together. You and your friend."
"Maybe one day. But I don't think today."
"You have no control over that."
"That's true."
"Then you speak nonsense."
"Believe what you want to." The woman's features turned suspicious. She said something to one of the men in another language that Decker didn't recognize. The man answered her and looked toward the window. He motioned for two of the men to check outside. The woman looked back at Decker.
"You are either very stupid or very brave."
"Right now, I'm not sure I'm either, actually." The woman pulled a gun from her pocket and placed it against Decker's forehead. The door to the house opened as the men came back inside, shaking their heads and gesticulating with their hands. The woman smiled at Decker.
"No, let us go with very stupid, shall we?"
There were two windows in the room in addition to the door. All three were blown inward and mini explosions rained over them, the smoke dense and acrid. The woman holding the gun screamed as she dropped it and fell to her knees. Jameson slid sideways off the couch. The other men toppled to the floor. Decker could see something at one of the windows, but only for an instant
before his eyes closed, and he too fell heavily to the floor. Chapter 77. Flashbangs really suck, Ross. Decker was sitting up in a chair, still looking woozy. Bogart patted him on the shoulder.
Sorry, it was the best we could do. And I'd think you'd agree it's better than being dead.
They were at an FBI field office 50 miles from the place where the kidnappers had taken Jameson. Melvin Mars was on the other side of him. He said,
I think it was a good thing you didn't rely on me to get you out of that jam, Decker.
Decker rubbed his ears and said, It was enough that you were willing to walk the plank with me, but you're right. I figured we'd need the big guns.
Bogart said, You did the right thing calling us in, Decker. We put the plan together pretty quickly. It was crazy and risky as hell.
But it worked.
Bogart held up a small device. You did a good job planting it.
I tripped over my own big feet and fell next to the van. I used that opportunity to stick it under the sidestep. Luckily, I was able to do it before they searched me. If I hadn't been able to do that,
you and Alex would be dead.
They never saw you coming, said Decker. Bogart smiled.
Hey, Decker, we are the FBI.
How's Alex?
Still resting. They banged her around some when they kidnapped her and sedated her, but no permanent damage.
You sure about that? Said Decker quickly.
I'm sure, Decker. She'll be fine.
And the others? Did they bug the Dabney's house? Did they kill Cecilia Randall?
We haven't gotten a word out of any of them. And I don't think we will, actually. They're a tough bunch.
So we're back to square one, then, said Decker.
Well, it is a plus that we just captured a bunch of foreign operatives.
I think they were speaking Russian.
Bogart nodded. We think so, too. If nothing else, it'll give us some leverage with Moscow.
But some of them were Middle Eastern, Ross, and the chatter was in Arabic. You think the Russians have teamed up with the jihadists?
I've found in this job that anything is possible.
But we still don't know where the strike is coming from, pointed out Decker.
No, but if we let it be known that we have their agents, then they might just call off whatever they're thinking about doing.
We can't count on that, said Decker.
We absolutely can't.
Mars said,
So what the hell do we do?
Figure out what they're planning to do and stop it, said Decker.
Milligan came into the room and sat down next to Bogart.
Okay, the State Department has been on the horn to their counterparts in Moscow. They are disavowing all knowledge of any of this.
That's no surprise, said Bogart.
None at all.
But this is a surprise.
They looked up to see Brown stride into the room.
She had caught a ride on the FBI jet with Bogart, Mars, and Milligan.
What is? Asked Bogart.
Folks at DIA just got off a secure communication with Moscow. It seems the Russians have also received similar threats through chatter.
Similar threats? Said Milligan. And you believe them?
We never believe anyone 100%, but our folks think they're actually being straight with us. They know that relations are delicate right now between Washington and Moscow. They have regional aspirations for sure, but it's not like they want to be drawn into a direct confrontation with us. That would only end badly for them. Their Achilles heel is their economy. It's nearly all fossil fuel-based, and the world's supply far exceeds demand. Because of that, Russia's economy is in freefall. They already have sanctions on them for the shit they pulled in Ukraine and Crimea. Another round of sanctions, and you might be talking revolution over there.
So what does that mean for our situation? Asked Bogart.
Because of all that, they were more forthcoming than they otherwise would be. They told us some things that jibed with things we'd previously discovered.
She paused and drew an anxious breath.
Bottom line, it might be a worst-case scenario.
How so? Asked Milligan.
We might be looking at a rogue third party. Berkshire's spy ring might have gone mercenary. If so, the traditional restraints that would keep Russia in check are not going to apply. We're totally in uncharted territory now.
Shit, muttered Bogart.
Milligan added, Maybe someone's trying to start something between Russia and us. Two superpowers going at it, it might leave an opening for another organization to gain an advantage somewhere.
And there are certainly enough mercenary players out there where they could recruit talent, opined Bogart. And that would explain the presence of the Middle Easterners and the chatter in Arabic.
Decker said, "So Berkshire might not have been working for her country any longer."
"Maybe she hasn't for a while," said Bogart.
Decker said, "That might explain the million-dollar condo and the expensive car. Rogues get paid in cash, not medals. She might have gotten tired of simply serving her country."
Mars looked at each of them before his gaze settled on Decker. "So you guys are really going to have to solve this thing, and fast."
Decker groaned and rubbed his head. "It would help if it didn't feel like Big Ben was pounding in my brain."
"Like you said, man, flashbangs suck," said Mars.
Chapter 78.
"You sure you're okay?"
Decker was sitting next to Jameson on her bed back at their apartment.
"I'm good, Decker, just tired. They roughed me up some before they drugged me. I don't know what they used, but it kicked the crap out of me."
"I'm sorry this happened."
"It's not your fault, Decker. You're the reason why I'm back here and not dead."
She suddenly sat up in bed and hugged him. Decker looked surprised by this, but finally patted Jameson on the back. She released him and said,
"Bogart told me how things stand. This rogue organization, we don't know what they're targeting."
"No, we don't. And whatever it is will happen soon."
"Even though you captured some of their people?"
"We can't assume it won't happen. By default, rogues are unpredictable."
"What are you going to do?"
Decker gazed over her shoulder out the window where it was raining again.
"I'm going to go for a walk."
His hood up, Decker trudged along in the rain. He didn't know why he liked bad weather. Well, maybe he did. On the day he'd found his family dead, it had been gloriously beautiful. Not a cloud in the sky, a gentle breeze, the sun shining like a beacon. And he'd come home that night to find the two people he loved most in the world murdered.
"I'll take the gloom."
He reached the river and paralleled it on his walk. The wind-swept water was churning up whitecaps, and seagulls were doing barrel rolls in the air. He found the same bench and sat down, oblivious to the rain pelting him and soaking his pants and shoes. Decker would never admit this to anyone, maybe not even to himself. He was terrified that there would come a day when he closed his eyes and flipped through his extraordinary memory, and the only thing that came out would be nothing. For that reason, he was now avoiding even doing it. This wasn't some secret weapon, like waving a magic wand that would produce exactly the answer you needed. Much of Decker's success in the past he could put down to simple, basic investigative legwork. Asking questions, looking at evidence, pondering how it all fit together, and finding in a quagmire of fact and fiction a lead that might take you where you needed to go. He had a lot to ponder this time. Maybe too much. But he had found out a lot, too. They had uncovered and busted up the spy ring's use of Dominion Hospice. They had discovered that it was Eleanor Dabney and Anne Berkshire who had worked together all that time as spies. They had found the truth behind Natalie's gambling debts, and with it the impetus for Walter Dabney to do what he had done. They knew why he had killed Anne Berkshire, and that his wife had, dressed as a clown, served as the signal that Berkshire was on her way. They had most likely found out what had happened to Cecilia Randall and the secret behind the dolls. They had, thankfully, rescued Jameson and captured members of the spy operation. Maybe they would eventually get some answers from those people. Yes, all those were good, positive things. But what they really had not determined was why Walter Dabney had chosen to shoot Anne Berkshire dead outside the Hoover Building. Despite what Ellie had told them about her husband wanting to send a message, Decker wasn't convinced. Then, just as the word athlete had popped into his head previously, another word did too. Literal. He jumped up and raced back to the apartment, changed into dry clothes, and checked on Jameson. She was sleeping soundly, and he grabbed her keys and went to her car, pointing it in the direction of where all this had happened. Along the way, he called Mars and then stopped to pick him up. As it turned out, Harper Brown was with him, so Decker left his car at the hotel where Mars was staying and they drove together to the place where it had all started for Decker.
"What's in your head, Decker?"
asked Brown. "Too many things."
"Come on, you need to give me more than that."
"I told you before that I thought Walter Dabney was being quite literal when he did something."
"Yeah, I remember that."
"Well, I think he was being quite literal when he killed Berkshire where he did." Brown exchanged a curious glance with Mars.
"I'm not following,"
she said to Decker. Only Decker wasn't listening. Traffic was a bear. Sirens were screeching all over, and they caught sight of a motorcade thundering through cleared lanes. Brown turned away from Decker and said to Mars,
"I hate it when we have visiting dignitaries. Screws traffic royally."
"We never worried about that in West Texas," said Mars.
"If you got behind another car on the road, that was a traffic jam." Brown rolled her eyes at this comment and said,
"Funny."
The traffic got so bad that they finally parked in a garage and hoofed it the rest of the way. The rain had let up some, but it was still a nasty, gloomy day. Her jacket hood up against the drizzle, Brown said,
"Okay, here we are near the Hoover Building. Now what?"
Decker was walking along slowly, covering the same route he'd taken on the morning that Dabney had shot Berkshire. He had done this so many times before that he had no idea what he thought he could possibly discover now. Possibly nothing. Probably nothing. But he had come here for a particular reason. He had thought of it when he'd been sitting on the bench by the river. It wasn't because his memory had served him particularly well. This was based on something far more simple, an educated hunch. He'd long relied on them when he'd been a detective back in Ohio. Now, this was where having perfect recall might really come in handy. He looked at everything in front of him, both sides of the street, up, down, left, right. While he was doing that, Brown was saying to Mars,
"This is one interesting town. You might enjoy living here."
He eyed her. "Is that an invitation?"
"I make no commitments,"
she said coyly.
"And expect none in return, but I do enjoy your company."
"Thought you wanted to cool it after what happened at your house. Then you showed up out of the blue."
"Well, after some serious deliberation, I thought it might be safer if I were there to protect you."
He laughed. "Okay, I have to admit that's the first time I've heard that from a woman."
"Well, maybe you haven't been hanging out with the right women,"
she shot back.
"I think you definitely have a point there."
Left, right, up, down. People. Places. Things. Decker closed his eyes and flipped back to that day, every frame, everything he'd seen. "Okay, got it." Now he superimposed the template he'd just taken in over the scene as it existed on the day Dabney had shot Berkshire. He immediately noted that some things were different. The burrito food truck was gone. The guard was not in the shack. The construction going on in the building across the street had ceased. But, like the last time he'd been here, the manhole cover was replaced, and the work site was gone. He looked up at the Hoover Building, squat, ugly, crumbling. Toilets that didn't work. Fire alarms out of order. Nets to catch falling chunks of concrete. And surveillance cameras that didn't work. He started running. Brown called after him.
"Decker!"
Mars said, "Hey, Amos!"
They ran after him, easily catching up. Decker turned the corner and came to a stop on the street, paralleling the one they'd been on.
"What is that?"
he asked as Brown stopped beside him, breathing a little bit hard.
"What is what?"
He pointed to the street. "That."
"Jesus, what do you think it is? It's a motorcade."
"Whose?"
"I don't know whose."
She studied it more closely, and then looked around at the tops of buildings.
"Okay, judging by the motorcade's length, and the firepower with it, and the counter-snipers on those rooftops, and all the suits with ear comms, I'd say VP on up. Maybe POTUS."
"So he's at the Hoover Building today?"
"He does go there from time to time."
Mars snapped his fingers.
"Hey, I was watching TV in the hotel gym this morning when I was working out, and that's when I saw it."
"Saw what?" snapped Decker.
"The president was coming here today to give out some award. It had to do with something we did with the Brits and the Germans. The Prime Minister and that lady who's the head of Germany are there, too. Brown said,
The President mentioned that when we met him at the White House. He was giving out an award for some sort of joint mission that saved lots of lives. Bogart knew about it.
The blood slowly drained from Decker's face. And the British Prime Minister and the German Chancellor are in there. Brown looked at him curiously.
Decker, what is it?
He turned to her. Walter Dabney knew something, only I don't think he knew exact details. Ellie Dabney said he was trying to send the terrorists a powerful message, she thought, to back off. She was right about him sending a message, but wrong about the recipient. He was trying to give us a message.
A message about what?
A message with no words.
You're making no...
A message with no words. He told us by his actions.
His actions?
He looked at her. He committed an act of violence at the Hoover Building. Brown slowly turned and glanced at the standing motorcade, then at the Hoover Building, and finally back at Decker. And then the blood drained from her face, too.
Oh, my God.
Chapter 79. Decker rushed back around to the other side of the building. He noted the empty guard shack again. With the president's visit, the guard was probably inside helping with security, he thought. Brown and Mars once more caught up to him. She said,
Decker, what are we going to do? Do you think they're going to somehow try to assassinate the president and the two other leaders? Do you think the shooters are already in the building?
Call Bogart. Tell him what we suspect. Melvin, come with me. They rushed off as Brown made the call. Decker ran over to the street and looked down at the manhole cover, and then he looked over at the Hoover Building. The day Dabney shot Berkshire, there were men working at this manhole.
What were they doing?
I don't know. He closed his eyes and thought back to that day. There was no utility truck that I could see. Mars looked more closely at the manhole cover.
It says Washington Gas.
Can you open it?
Mars bent down and gripped the top of the cover. Decker, it's been sealed. Look.
Brown had come up to them.
The Secret Service seals all the manhole covers the motorcade will pass over.
She paused and looked confused.
But the motorcade is on the other block, so I don't think they came down this way.
Did you reach Bogart? Asked Decker. She nodded but looked sick to her stomach.
Decker, he's in the Hoover Building, at the ceremony.
Damn it! Did you tell him they need to evacuate the building?
I told him what you suspected, but Decker, he can't stop the ceremony and evacuate the building based on that. He said to call him back if we come up with something else.
What, like when the president's dead? Snapped Decker.
In a calming voice, Mars said, Decker, what else do you remember from that day?
Decker focused on him. I remember a utility truck going into the FBI building, and the guard told me that most of the exterior surveillance cameras are out of order.
Anything else?
Decker glanced sharply at the building across from the Hoover. There were workmen carrying materials into that building. He led them over to it and they tried to peer through the windows, but they were taped over with thick paper on the inside. Decker tried the door. It was locked. He stepped back and looked up. I don't think there's anyone in this building.
It's being renovated,
said Brown, pointing at a sign on one of the windows. Then you think people would be working here, wouldn't you? She looked confused.
Do you think there's a sniper's nest in there? But the motorcade is on the next street over. They'd have no shot from here.
Decker said, Call the gas company and find out if they had a team out here working on any lines under that manhole on the day Berkshire was killed.
That might take some time.
Just do it, snapped Decker. Decker pulled his phone and called Bogart. The FBI agent answered and, speaking in a low voice, said,
Decker, I already told Brown I can't evacuate. The ceremony just started. But
Decker interrupted. What was the meeting about that Dabney was supposed to attend at the FBI when he shot Berkshire?
What?
The meeting. What was it for?
Why does it matter? He obviously never intended to be there.
But he picked that day to kill Berkshire, Ross, so just tell me, snapped Decker.
Okay. Dabney's firm was consulting on some renovation work here.
As you know, a new building is a long way off, so they have to do work on myriad systems here. Security, electrical, and other infrastructure. Decker clicked off. He glanced around and then hustled to an alley and turned down it. Mars and Brown, her phone to her ear, ran after him. Decker reached an exterior door to the building. He tried the knob, but it was locked. Brown and Mars reached him, and she said,
Decker, what the hell is going on?
Ellie Dabney said Berkshire's spy ring wanted her husband to work for them.
But he refused.
I think he was smarter than that. He did that video, right? I think he met with them, pretended to be interested, and felt them out for what they were interested in. And what they were interested in was his work with the FBI on renovating their building. That was the meeting he was going to when he shot Berkshire. That was his second message to us, after the location of the attack.
You mean the president is the target? Said Mars.
Decker didn't answer.
But why not just tell us directly before he shot Berkshire?
Said Brown. Probably because he didn't know their exact plan, and they found out about the video and removed it, which probably told him that they were watching his every move, monitoring his every communication. They probably threatened him and his family. He does anything else to thwart them, they're all dead. This was probably the only way he could see to do it.
But why didn't they kill him after they found out what he did with the video?
Asked Brown. Because that might have drawn suspicion to him at a time when they couldn't afford it. They probably decided it was smarter to keep a close watch on him and then strike if he showed any signs of trying to go around them again. They didn't know the Dabneys were planning to kill Berkshire. He looked at Mars. Want to pretend that door is a blocking sled? Mars smiled and nodded. I feel like I want to hit something. They backed up and charged forward. Nearly 600 pounds of flesh and bone hit the door at speed. And the door lost. They fell to the floor on top of it, but were quickly on their feet. Brown hurried in after them. Decker raced forward with the two on his heels. The interior of the building was a shell, with cables and electrical lines dangling from the ceiling. A set of scaffolding set up in one corner, some buckets with mops in them, and a few hand tools and power saws on workbenches, and a couple of sets of working lights. The only thing missing was anyone actually working. Where are the workers? Said Mars.
Maybe because the president is here?
Said Brown doubtfully. Decker said, This all looked staged, in case anyone bothered to look.
Wait a minute. What are you saying?
Said Brown. The woman who kidnapped Alex? I told her that even if she killed us, the FBI was a big organization and would keep after her. She said, No one knows what the future will bring.
You're not saying...
gasped Brown. The target isn't just the president and the two other leaders. They're just the bonus. They told us the target might be symbolic. Well, the Hoover Building is pretty symbolic.
There are 11,000 people in that building,
Brown exclaimed. This way, Decker barked. He was pointing to a set of stairs leading down. As they raced down the steps, he said, Anything from the gas company?
You won't be surprised to learn that they put me on hold. I'm currently listening to the Bee Gees.
They raced down two flights until they reached the basement. This, too, was an open shell. They looked around until Mars said, Over here. They joined him at the spot. They were staring at a huge spool of cable against one wall. It was taller than Decker.
What would this be doing down here?
Asked Brown. Decker peered through the opening in the middle of the spool where ordinarily a forklift's tines would be inserted to lift it. I can't see through it. He stuck his arm in and felt around. It's been filled with something. It feels like concrete.
Why would they have done that?
Asked Brown. Decker tried to look behind it, but the spool was set right against the wall. One reason would be to completely cover up whatever might be behind it, he replied. He looked at Mars. Ready? He and Mars put their shoulders against one side of the spool, squatted down, and started pushing. The spool was immensely heavy, but the two men were enormously strong and, at least in their youths, accustomed to pushing large objects around. They strained and their feet slipped against the floor, and they swore and sweated and their veins bulged, but inch by inch, the spool rolled. Finally, a hole in the wall was revealed. It had been punched right through the concrete. Decker peered into the dark tunnel that stretched ahead. Anybody got a flashlight? Brown held up her phone and clicked on its light. Then she pulled her gun. Decker did the same. She led the way. Mars looked at Decker. You got any idea what's going on here, Decker? Decker glanced at him, his expression probably as serious as Mars had ever seen on the man. The end of the chatter, Melvin, and maybe the end of everything else along with it. Chapter 80. They worked their way down the tunnel, finally coming to a junction where they saw a single beam of light from far above them. Brown pointed her phone light that way.
It's the underside of the manhole,
she hissed.
The light is coming from the grab hole in the plate.
Which means we're under the street, said Decker. Way under the street.
This must be what that manhole work was about,
said Brown.
They were somehow connecting up from the building we were in to this utility tunnel.
They hurried along and finally came to another junction. There was rubble and dirt piled up. They also broke through here, said Decker. This appears to be where the utility tunnel originally ended. They passed through the hole and into another tunnel. How did all this happen right under the street and no one notice? Said Mars.
It's not right under the street,
replied Brown.
We've been angling down this whole time. My guess is we're over 30 feet down and there's tons of dirt above us. Natural soundproofing.
They kept walking. So where the hell are we now? Asked Mars, looking nervously around. Decker glanced at Brown. She looked ominously back at him. She said,
I think we're under the Hoover Building.
They kept moving forward until they reached another hole punched in the wall. Only this one bled off to the side of the tunnel they were in.
They cautiously entered a large space.
They moved forward and rounded a corner. Another hole had been broken through the wall here. As they drew closer to it, all three immediately began to cough and wheeze.
What the hell is that? Gasped Mars.
It's gas, said Decker, who pulled his jacket over his nose and mouth. He crouched and passed through the hole and into another room. There were enormous blackened concrete columns, a low ceiling, and a pile of rubble in the center of the room. His mouth and nose still covered. Decker looked down at the hole next to the pile of rubble. An exposed pipe was lying in the trench. It looked to him like a long, venomous serpent. Brown and Mars, their mouths and noses covered as well, joined him and stared down at the pipe. There was a hissing sound coming from the trench.
The pipe's been compromised,
Brown said hoarsely.
That's where the gas is coming from.
Shouldn't they have sensors or alarms for this? Said Decker. Brown pointed to the ceiling where several white-domed devices were attached.
They do both, but I bet they've been bypassed somehow.
What's that thing? Said Mars, pointing to the right.
Brown and Decker looked there, and both of them froze. It was a cylindrical metal device with wires coming out of the top. It looked like an oxygen tank that a scuba diver would use. It was attached to the pipe. Brown immediately said,
It's a bomb.
And it's got a timer, said Decker. The flashing digital clock was counting down. There were 4 minutes to go.
It looks too small to do too much damage, said Mars, especially all the way down here.
Brown shook her head and coughed.
The bomb's only the trigger. This place is full of gas. That's where the explosive punch is going to come from.
She looked over at the columns.
And I'm betting those are load-bearing. The bomb goes off, the gas ignites, and those columns are going to go.
Decker added, And the entire Hoover Building and everyone in it are going to come down. It's like how they implode buildings scheduled for demolition.
Let's just take the bomb and get it out of here then, said Mars.
He reached for it, but Brown grabbed his hand.
No. Do you see those blue wires? They're accelerators. You take it off the pipe, the countdown clock goes to zero, and boom.
How do you know that?
She was a bomb specialist in the Army, answered Decker. Brown said,
Decker, you've got to call Bogart and tell him to get the president out of here and then evacuate this place. Now. Don't make the call from in here. I have no idea if something in the phone might either set off the gas or accelerate the countdown, and you probably can't get reception here anyway.
But
Decker, move your ass. This is what I did for a living. Go. It's the president, for God's sake.
Okay, but...
Just go.
I'm staying with you, said Mars. I can help.
You can do jack shit. Now go with Decker. I'll be along when I'm done.
But Harper... She screamed.
Damn it, Melvin. I've got 3 minutes to do this. Get out of here.
Decker grabbed Mars's arm and pulled him away. They reached the hole and went through it. Mars looked back at Brown, coughing and wheezing, her jacket over her nose and mouth, as she squatted over the bomb. Then he and Decker raced down the tunnel. When they were far enough away from the gas, he got a signal and called Bogart. All Bogart said was, "Got it." Decker looked at his watch. Mars did too. 2 damn minutes, he said, staring at Decker. I got to go back, Decker. I got to go help her. Me too. They ran back down the tunnel. When they got close, the gas was now so thick that they clutched their heads and staggered. Mars hit the wall, and Decker nearly sank to his knees, his head pounding. Come on, screamed Mars, righting himself. They stumbled down the tunnel, reached the hole, and fell through it. Both men were violently sick to their stomachs. Harper! Called out Mars. He had dropped his phone and couldn't see in the darkness. Far above, Decker thought he heard rumblings. They were evacuating the building, his muddled mind realized. He and Mars got up and staggered forward, but they were now both disoriented as the gas overwhelmed their brains and their lungs. We've got to find her, fast, said Decker, before we pass out. Over there, Mars managed to say. They crawled forward. The pile of rubble was still there, but there was no sign of Brown. Gasping, Mars reached the hole first. Decker joined him a second later. They both stared down at the burning red numbers on the detonator. They were not moving. They were stuck at 4 seconds. Two wires had been pulled free from the device. Where's Harper? Gasped Mars. Decker, his jacket pulled over his mouth and nose, looked groggily around. Harper Brown had fallen into the tunnel 2 feet from the bomb, her body wedged between the pipe and the wall. Decker reached down, grabbed her arm, and pulled. Mars saw what he was doing, jumped across the hole, and helped him. With their combined strength, they quickly pulled her up. Mars slung her over his shoulder. They stumbled to the hole in the wall and then picked up speed, racing along and occasionally bouncing off the walls of the tunnel. When they were far enough away to where they couldn't smell the gas, they stopped and Mars set Brown down. They sucked in air, their heads clearing. Brown's eyes were closed. She was turning blue, and there was something else. Decker, she's not breathing! Screamed Mars. He dropped to the floor of the tunnel and started performing CPR, pumping her chest. Help me, Decker! Help me! Decker dropped down next to him and started breathing into Brown's mouth after pinching closed her nose. Come on, come on, breathe! Pleaded Mars. Please, Harper, please! Don't go! Don't leave! He kept pumping, and Decker kept breathing. And despite all that, Harper Brown remained still. Chapter 81. Decker was in a suit and tie. His hair was cut and neatly parted at the side, and plastered down with lots of hair gel. Melvin Mars was next to him, dressed as formally as his friend. Behind them was Jameson, in a black dress and matching stockings. Decker checked his watch. It's time. They walked down the hall to an auditorium. It was full, and Bogart and Milligan were already there in the front row. Bogart looked up and caught their eye. He indicated the empty seats next to them. On the raised dais was a podium with a microphone. Behind that was the United States flag on one side and the flag of the DIA on the other. On the wall behind was the DIA seal. Decker stared at the seal, and his mind went back to the first time he'd seen it and how Brown had described it to him. The black represented the unknown, while the flames and eagle represented knowledge and intelligence. And didn't those seem in short supply these days? Yet they had broken through the unknown, hadn't they? But everything came with a price. The director of the DIA appeared from the left side of the stage and approached the podium. He brought the ceremony to order and gave a few introductory remarks. Then he turned it over to a man who came out from stage right. Everyone in attendance instantly rose to his or her feet. Those in uniform saluted. The President of the United States walked to the lectern. He had no teleprompter, and he carried no notes. He adjusted the mic and looked out over the audience. Though exactly what happened at the Hoover Building has been largely kept classified for obvious reasons, we are here today to honor a patriot who acted with great heroism, without regard for her personal safety, and whose unselfish acts saved a great many people. As you know, this award is ordinarily given out by the Office of the Director of National Intelligence. However, since I number myself among those that she saved, I owe our recipient a great personal debt, one which I'm afraid I will never be able to repay. As some of you already know, her name will today be added to the DIA's torchbearer's wall, not far from her father's. In the front row, Mars put a hand over his eyes and bowed his head. Decker put a supportive hand on his shoulder. The president continued, "Thus, it is with tremendous honor and the greatest respect that I present to Major Harper C. Brown the highest honor the national intelligence community can bestow, the National Intelligence Cross for valor and heroism above and beyond the call of duty." As one, the crowd rose to its feet as Harper Brown, in her full dress uniform, appeared from backstage and wheeled herself out to the podium. From the chair, she crisply saluted the president. He returned the salute, presented the award, draping it around her neck, and then shook her hand. They both turned to the audience as the president said, "Major Harper Brown, your National Intelligence Cross Award recipient." Everyone in the room cheered, with Melvin Mars perhaps the loudest of all. Brown looked over the crowd, waved, and smiled even as the tears rolled down her cheeks. Then her gaze searched for and found Decker. She smiled and her eyes crinkled. He smiled and gave her a salute. Then she spotted Mars next to him. She winked. He grinned. When she looked away, Decker said, "The doctors think she'll be back to full strength pretty soon."
"Thank God for that.
Why were you crying before, Melvin?"
"Damn, Decker, we almost lost her. The EMTs told us she'd probably died, but that we brought her back.
It was that close." "I know, but she's alive, Melvin. Keep focusing on that."
He looked over at Jameson, who was still clapping and grinning. He caught her eye and she said,
"She looks great, doesn't she?"
"Never better," said Decker, grinning.
"And you don't look bad in a suit and tie," added Bogart.
Milligan nodded appreciatively. "In fact, you're starting to look like a real FBI agent, Decker. Maybe we need to start holding you to a dress code."
Decker's smile faded, and he stopped clapping.
Decker, Mars, and Jameson got out of the car in front of Dominion Hospice. Mars was holding a box. Jameson said,
"We're going to Harper's for dinner tomorrow night, don't forget."
"Already bought the wine," said Mars. "And she lost the wheelchair for good. They said she had some temporary weakness because of what happened with the gas, but she's all fine now."
"And does that mean you're moving to the area permanently?"
asked Jameson coyly.
"Already got a contract down on a house that, what do you know, is only a couple blocks from her. We can go running together."
Jameson said,
"Hey, I'm in on that."
"Cool, Alex."
Mars looked at Decker.
"How about you?"
"How about me what?" he groused.
"You want to run with us?"
"Only if you're chasing a criminal."
As they walked to the front doors, Jameson said,
"Hey, Decker, couple of questions."
He looked at her.
"So I get that Dabney's work at the FBI gave the bad guys the idea for attacking the FBI, but what was the information exactly?"
"He was working on the building's infrastructure,
To do that, he had been given highly classified information about the building's support structure and that gas line running under it, plus info on the maze of tunnels under the street and the Hoover Building. That's what Berkshire's people really wanted. Bogart found out that they had already leased the building across the street, probably for surveillance purposes on the FBI. But now, with what Dabney had given them, they were able to draw up a new plan and worked around the clock to link up with the utility tunnel and take it under the Hoover Building and then sabotage the gas line. They also found out when the president and other world leaders would be there. They wanted to take them all out, kill 11,000 people, and cripple America's premier crime-fighting agency. She nodded, taking this in.
Okay. Remember when Walter Dabney told Natalie about the story from Disney World? His riding in the ambulance?
Yeah, what about it?
Why did he tell her that?
Because he's only human. She looked confused.
What?
Dabney knew at that point about his wife's spying, but he was too honorable to tell his kids. He didn't want them to hate her. But he also knew he was going to shoot Berkshire and kill himself, so he couldn't resist telling his daughter a story that had him being the one who was there for her, and not her mother. They entered the building and started down the hall. Any word on what will happen to Mrs. Dabney and her daughter? Asked Mars. Even though she voluntarily stopped spying, Ellie Dabney is going to do some serious prison time. Natalie might get off with some sort of probation. They can't prove she knew anything about the actual espionage. They checked in at the front desk and were led back to Joey Scott's room. The little boy was lying in the bed with his eyes closed. Their escort, a nurse, gently roused him. When he opened his eyes, she told him about his visitors, then turned and left. The three of them drew closer to the bed. "Hey, Joey," said Mars. Joey smiled weakly and lifted his hand in a wave before it dropped back to the bed.
"Got something for you."
He opened the box and pulled out a football. He held it in front of the boy and said,
"Look who signed it for you."
Joey looked at the writing on the ball, and his eyes grew large.
"To my friend Joey, Peyton Manning,"
read Joey. Decker added, "And he sent a signed picture, too." He held up the framed photo so Joey could see it. "I'm going to put it on your nightstand. You can look at it whenever you want." They all drew up chairs and sat next to the bed. Mars placed the ball next to Joey. The little boy put his hand on the pigskin and rubbed the spot where Manning had signed. Jameson whispered to Mars,
"How did you score that?"
"Friend of a friend who works at the NFL. They told me that when Manning heard about Joey, he wanted to fly out here and meet him. I think he's actually going to do that."
"Wow,"
said Jameson. She took a book from her bag and opened it to a certain page.
"Joey, I'm going to finish reading The Prisoner of Azkaban to you, okay? The last part is so exciting."
He smiled.
"Okay."
While Jameson started to read, Decker put his hands on the bed rail and stared down at Joey. Every once in a while, Joey would look up at them and smile. And Decker found himself each time smiling back. He had lost Molly at about the same age Joey was now. And he knew that Joey didn't have much longer to live. It hadn't been that long since Decker had first met the boy, and Joey already seemed much weaker. Decker could see his body shutting down little by little. But for now, Decker saw no blue at all. He just saw a boy smiling while holding a football signed by a hero of his. Decker's life was complicated, his future probably even more so, but for right now, he forgot about having a perfect memory, or the horrific way by which he'd acquired it. He stopped thinking for at least a little while about the family he had lost. He glanced at the two people next to him, who were his friends. Two people who, despite his many shortcomings, would always be his friends. Then he looked back down at Joey. The boy's eyes were closed, but his hand remained firmly attached to the precious football. Decker reached out a big hand and gently stroked Joey's head. As he did so, he felt his eyes moisten. But for now, right this instant, things were okay. Decker had taken to thinking of this now as his bench. The skies were growing darker, and the wind was picking up. The river flowed in front of him, and in the swift currents he could see his own thoughts hurtling along.
He put his hands in the pockets of his jacket and closed his eyes. Yet this time, he was not engaging his prodigious memory. No perfect recall was required for what he wanted to think about. For a man who didn't like change, there was a great deal of it heading his way. A new job at the FBI. Being a landlord with Jameson. Mars moving here. Harper Brown becoming a fixture in his life through her relationship with Mars. He didn't even know if Jameson wanted to continue working at the FBI. She might leave and do something else. For all he knew, Mars and Brown might get married and move away. Bogart and Milligan might get transferred. And then it would just be him. Amos Decker, from small town Ohio, transplanted to this very strange land known as Washington, D.C. Alone. Again. He rubbed his eyes and put his hand back in his pocket. The good moment sitting with Joey Scott had been a welcome one, but it was now over. Though he could never equate what he was going through with the terminal illness that the little boy was enduring, Decker knew that his future was crowded with uncertainty. His damaged mind could change at any time. He could morph into yet another person, as unrecognizable as the one he was now, eroding even further the person he used to be. The sheer force of his memories could end up destroying him. He could be living in a cardboard box again. He could be alone, with nothing and no one. As the anxiety he was feeling built, he closed his eyes and took several deep breaths. Just keep it together, Decker. Just keep it together.
You look like you could use this.
He opened his eyes and saw Jameson standing there. She had two cups of takeout coffee. She handed one to him and sat down on the bench.
How'd you know where I was? He asked, rubbing his eyes again and not looking at her.
I have my little sources,
she said, smiling and then taking a sip of her coffee.
It's pretty here.
Is it? Asked Decker.
She glanced at him.
You look like you have a lot on your mind.
Just the usual.
There is nothing usual about you.
He drank his coffee and said, So Melvin moving here? Him and Brown a couple? What about you?
What about me what?
Trying to keep his voice nonchalant and failing miserably, Decker said, You gonna stick with the FBI?
Are you?
I don't have anything else in my life, Alex.
I think you have a lot more in your life than you think.
So you'll stay?
If you do, I do.
He looked at her strangely. That simple? She nodded. Why? He asked.
I'm surprised you have to ask, Decker.
What do you mean?
That's what I meant when I said I had your back.
She tapped her coffee cup against his, sat back, and closed her eyes. Decker watched her for a few moments and then turned to look at the river. This time, he kept his eyes wide open.
This has been a Hachette Audio production of The Fix, written by David Baldacci, read by Keith Brewer and Orla Cassidy, produced and directed by Cheryl Smith, recorded by Charles McCrory and Michelle Figueroa, post-production by Beat Street Productions. The Fix is also available in print and digital formats from Grand Central Publishing, a division of Hachette Book Group. For more Hachette Audio productions, visit us at hachetteaudio.com. Thank you for listening. Text copyright 2017 by Columbus Rose Limited. Audio production copyright 2017, Hachette Audio, all rights reserved. Hachette Book Group supports the right to free expression and the value of copyright. The purpose of copyright is to encourage writers and artists to produce the creative works that enrich our culture. The duplicating, uploading, and distribution of this audiobook without permission is a theft of the author's intellectual property. If you would like permission to use material from the audiobook, other than for review purposes, please contact permissions at hbgusa.com. Thank you for your support of the author's rights. This audiobook is a work of fiction. Names, characters, places, and incidents are either the product of the author's imagination or are used fictitiously, and any resemblance to actual persons, living or dead, events, or locales is entirely coincidental.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.